Phil McKibben is with us. It is a great honor to be with you for 20 years since you first came to wide public attention with The End of Nature. And for more than that, as you were working your way toward that, Bill Russell and I have been following your important work. And I at least speak not for you, Bill, but I find that there is kind of a bookend sense between The End of Nature and Deep Economy, that it's the same story, radically different and radically the same.
The End of Nature was the first book for a general audience about global warming. And the understanding of the kind of trouble that we were in and are in, and the trouble's gotten worse, has haunted me ever since. And pretty much everything I've written, the dozen books since, have, in one way or another, though they've often been about diverse topics, have been an effort to kind of try to come to grips with how we might figure out a society that worked in the face of how we might make the changes we need to make. Deep Economy is an effort to get at the very heart of that, which is our economic life, and to understand what choices we made in the last 50 years that left us so incredibly dependent on burning fossil fuel in order to make our way in the world, and what choices we might make that would allow us a different lease on life in the years ahead.
I think of this as learning to tell different stories, that there is a different way of living life, that the one that we grew up with, which is, you know, you characterize it as just an obsession with growth, particularly as manifested in economics and consumption. And yet there are people all over the world who are living in many ways better lives, happier lives, by most standards, almost any standard except that growth standard, are to be preferred. And it seems that the trick is in telling stories.
Yeah. And of course, our problem is that we hear stories constantly. They're on the commercials 1,000 times a day. They're, you know, seductive stories about what it is that's going to make us happy. And it's so interesting to try to figure out whether or not that actually worked. You know, every year since the end of World War II, one of the big polling firms asked Americans, are you happy with your life? The number of Americans who say, yes, I'm very happy with my life, peaks in 1956. I didn't know what was going on then before I was born, but it peaks in 1956 and goes slowly but steadily downhill since, even as our material standard of living trebles. Now, you know, think about it. I mean, we have appliances people hadn't even thought of in the 1950s, you know. We've got houses twice, three, four times the size. We jump on planes to take vacations to exotic parts in the world. What the heck is going on that it's not making us incredibly happy? And the answer, I think, is pretty clear when you look at the data or when you even think about your own life. We decided that the American dream consisted mostly of building bigger houses farther apart from each other. That defined success. And that's why people in Atlanta drive, you know, 2 hours a day to get to work and back or whatever it is. Well, what's the effect of that? You do have your big house out in the suburbs, and you have to heat and cool and light it, so there's a lot of environmental damage. But you also, and this is the even bigger effect, you just, by the very nature of things, don't run into people as much. Your contact is way reduced. The average American has half as many close friends as they did 50 years ago. That's an amazing change.
And you're talking about a social animal.
Look, we evolved from animals that spent all day picking lice out of each other's fur, you know? That's what we're sort of, and they needed to get the lice out, but they also needed to be, you know,
touched.
In contact, right?
Yeah.
And so, of course, we're sort of get sort of depressed. I mean, you know, that's what we were built for. It's what we evolved for. And it shouldn't surprise us that, you know, we're having to reach for the, you know, Paxil and Zoloft and whatever in record quantities, because we're not getting what we need. We're getting stuff. To a certain point, stuff works. If you're poor in China, you know, living in some rural, well, you know, a little more money means that you might have enough food to eat. You might be able to have a room with just your wife and your kid in it, not, you know, your entire extended family. You might even have heat in the winter, you know. That's good. Your life gets better.
That's also true in Southeast Atlanta.
There you go.
Or west side of Chicago or whatever.
Exactly right. But past a certain point, that effect disappears.
And in fact, you have a number for that.
That's right. The economists have been pretty consistent now in looking around the world and saying that once people get past about $10,000 per capita income per year, so for an American family, 40 grand a year, there's no longer any correlation between more and more satisfaction. The numbers just start scattering.
That's very interesting, because if you look at what people who pay attention to what it takes to actually live and, you know, to have health care and all the things that that are necessary, that the poverty level is actually somewhere around $33,000 a year for a family of four. Mm-hmm. So effectively what you're saying is that once you deal with that basic economic condition, that after that, the how to say, the marginal utility, as the economist
exactly
would
right.
put it, is you know, diminishes fairly rapidly, and at a cost.
Bingo. I mean, that's exactly right. And of course, one of the great shames of our society is we have way more than enough money to make every family in America at that level, you know? And instead, we have people with way too much, and we have people with way too little. And it's, I mean...
And there are tremendous costs to that.
Absolutely.
I have a friend who joined me in something we call theoecology at the Interdenominational Theological Center, which reaches out across both the nation and the world. And after spending 2 days thinking about, well, what would theoecology be, he said, whatever we say, it has to start with a new idea of enough. I thought, well, gosh, I can remember enough.
I wrote a book once called Enough, and it was sort of about that very question, and it's the most un-American of words, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Can't have enough. But I think that's starting to change.
Before you go away from that, I really hadn't thought of it this way. The operating driving principle behind what they're doing at the ITC, with this theoecology, is the notion of creating a new, not going back, but a new Eden, which is not, I think, alien to what you've written about and what you're talking about. You know, you can't go back. That old bucolic state, mm-hmm. it is not going to happen.
That was then, this is now.
Well, things have changed. Lots has changed. We have a lot more people. Mm-hmm. But the idea of trying to work together to puzzle out what that condition would be like, and it'll be different for different people, but in a way that's very much at the center, I think, of what you're doing with this book, but also what you're doing with your other work.
Absolutely. Connection is the, I think, the key. And we have, you know, there are some new ways to make connections now, and we need to take advantage of them.
Like
the web, which is a really interesting technology that we haven't figured out yet how, you know, exactly how it's going to work. And we know that it does some bad and damaging things, and we know it does some interesting ones. And so we've been doing a lot of political organizing around climate change, using the web to bring people together in real life in their communities. We managed to organize 1,400 demonstrations last year on one day, all around the country, all 50 states on global warming, the biggest day of grassroots environmental action since Earth Day 1970.
Shall I get out my T-shirt that says,
yeah,
Step It
that's
Up?
That's good. Absolutely right. And we did all that, you know, with no money, over the web with me and some college kids. And it was exciting to see how you could help people get together in their communities in real life and then knit them together on the web into something more than the sum of their parts. I don't know. It was...
That must have been thrilling.
It was very interesting.
On the story subject, you told a story earlier today that it seems to me to be right at the core of this, particularly for people who feel helpless in the face of all these challenges. And that's a story about you and a few of your friends decided to go for a walk.
Let's do that when we come back.
And the political implications and the moral implications and the spiritual and community and all.
Well, the thing I want to say before we go away for a break is The notion of being depressed, part of what why I was the same sense of direction is when one's depressed, one gets paralyzed. Mm-hmm. And part of what the magic is in thinking about how do we save life on Earth mm-hmm. is that you don't have to be paralyzed right. anymore. Bill McKibben is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I invite you to be with us when we return in just a moment.